Let's go back to Helen Leach now, Otago University Emeritus Professor and Culinary Anthropologist. Hello, Helen.
Hello there.
Nice to have you back on the show again. I think last time I talked to you as Culinary Anthropologist, it was one of those dreaded phone calls you must receive about every 6 months where we were calling up and saying, Helen, can you tell us about the history of the pavlova? So I'm pleased not to be asking you to do that again.
No, I refuse to discuss it.
Yeah, good. Hey, tell me about the research you've been doing.
Well, I had been following up on supersizing, and I realised, of course, that when a recipe is published as being a classic, it should conform to the earlier editions of a certain work in which it is listed. And it should say the same number of slices. But in fact, nice, very nice and famous biscuits that were made on trays and on for good occasions, family, taking things in your lunchbox and so on, that they were recommending smaller sizes. The smaller sizes were the number of portions. And I saw that something, a recipe that used to make 36 pieces suddenly only made 24 pieces, or 20 pieces only made 12 pieces. So because the actual ingredients were identical, it meant that they were being supersized.
That is amazing.
Now, but more happened because I found some things in which only the top part got supersized and the bottom stayed the same. And one of those was ginger crunch. And we face that in our cafes and supermarkets every day. And we think that is the norm. It's not the norm. It's much more recent to have those doubled and or even tripled icing on top of the ginger crunch. In the old day, it was a very thin layer, just a few millimetres, and it was the underneath part was crunchy. Well, it isn't crunchy anymore, especially not if you multiply the icing amount by, say, 3 or 4.
So hang on. You're saying that different parts of the same slice or biscuit are changing out of proportion to the other part?
Absolutely. Now, sometimes it's the base of the little cake or whatever it is. Perhaps it's a Louise cake or something familiar. That's got a history well over 100 years. Now, you can trace the proportions of sugar to butter to flour for decade after decade after decade, and they're always the same. And the flour is always the biggest amount, and then the sugar, and then the butter. Now, all of a sudden, in about the year 2000, people stopped those proportions. They stopped citing them. Their recipes had equal portions, or even recipes with more sugar than there was flour. Now, that changes the texture of it, and it changes the kilocalorie content of it too, which is what we've been talking about today in our conference. So this is nothing to do with supersizing. This is enrichment. And it's something you don't pick up unless you've got an old version of the recipe to compare it with. So people obviously are throwing away their old cookbooks, and they're not going back to look and see what Louise cakes were like back in the 1950s or when, in the pre-metric days. So I then found this example, this enrichment process going on besides supersizing, and it goes back even earlier than supersizing. And it's, to my mind, if you really increase the amount of sugar and butter in something compared to the flour, then you are asking for, impaired health, to say the least.
Yeah. When did it begin, these changes?
Well, some of them go back a very long time. We inherited a biscuit with a very politically incorrect name. It was Chinese Chews, which was a homemade biscuit, and we inherited that from the Americans. Now, the Americans never put butter on it, and the whole time they made it, which was for decades and decades. And it's a lovely, chewy recipe if you make it. When it got to New Zealand and Australia, the home cooks decided that it needed some butter in it, just a little bit at first, And in no time, it was 250 grams of butter, or even more than that. So the whole texture of it changed. Now, when do you think that change occurred? Well, it was in the Depression. And I thought, how come they're increasing, you know, intake of these things in the Depression? Well, people who still had income benefited by the collapse in the price of sugar and butter during the Depression years. So suddenly, there was all this butter around. It had never been as cheap before. It wouldn't be again. And so they rushed out and they invented all sorts of cooking and changed recipes and made the most of our butter. And they did the same with sugar, because both of them, in fact, halved in terms of a pound.
Where did you do this research?
Where or when?
Well, like, what was your source?
I have a collection, as you probably know, of 2,300 New Zealand published cookbooks.
No, I didn't know that. That's great.
Well, I couldn't have written that, you know, the story of Pavlova and the Christmas cake and so on, if I hadn't have had so many to work on. I make great big data spreadsheets, so and that suddenly I start to see these trends showing up, and it's very exciting.
What do we learn from this then? What's been going on?
Well, I think in the case of the addition of sugar during the Depression, it was because people were trying to compensate for the fact that a lot of people were out of work, a lot of people couldn't have anything sweet at all. Those women who still had access and to an income, they decided to make the best of a bad job, perhaps. And so they started adding the butter in increasing amounts. Then after the war, you get the removal of the rationing in the late 1940s. And all of a sudden people think, oh, goodness me, now we can bake again because we have got infinite supplies of butter. Now, the thing was, the butter was price controlled. And so we all got used to it. Going out to the grocer, getting a pound of butter for 2 shillings. And that went on for years and years. It was, you know, the price was protected. So no wonder we enhanced recipes with butter.
So you think that's the main driver, the reaction to the lean years,
I mean, certainly there's an element of being addicted to sugar. I mean, we all like it and we learn to like it. We learn to like it from the circumstances in which sweets are handed around and nice biscuits and so on. But people don't forget when prices were so bad that they had to cut down, for example, when they couldn't you buy butter, they'd spend sixpence a pound for suet or the stuff that's left in the pan after you've had a roast. So people compensated, and they didn't like compensating. So when everything relaxed again and things improved or the prices fell, then they made the most of it.
This is amazing. 50s, yeah, it's amazing research, and it's the sort of thing that we would never probably know unless someone like you was doing it. I hope you've got some PhD students or something who you're training up.
No, I'm doing it on my own. Mm. As the case may be, I follow up particular recipes. I'm always on the lookout for recipes that have been around for a long, long time. And then you can see some wonderful trends. For example, in scones. Scones show up in Scottish cookbooks in about the 1830s. And then you can track them through and all the different flavours and the, you know, varieties of them. And they eventually get so rich that they are made from a soft drink. And I'm not going to name the type of scone, but it is a very, very high kilocalorie scone. And I think that the original Scottish makers of scones would find it absolutely astonishing that you could make a scone from cream and soft drink and a bit of flour.
Hey, man, I've really enjoyed chatting to you. We've got to catch up more often. Keep us in touch with what you're working on, Helen, and thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Helen Leach, Emeritus Professor at Otago University and culinary anthropologist. She's gone through those recipes one by one. from the earliest to the most recent, and she's discovered that there's that we're serving them bigger, that the tops, the sweet part, is getting bigger, and the proportion of sweet and fatty ingredients to the other ingredients is increasing as well.